Thank you for listening to this Spectator podcast. Before you start, I'm just here to briefly tell you about our Brexit flash sale. You can get 10 issues of The Spectator for the price of one in our flash sale, plus a commemorative Brexit mug absolutely free. It has the butterfly completely out of the box, which is the cover of our issue this week. The offer ends on Monday, and you can go to spectator.co.uk/sale.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm John Connolly and I'm joined today by Fraser Nelson and Katie Balls. Now, last night at 1 hour to midnight, Big Ben may not have bonged as many people hoped, but Britain did finally at long last leave the European Union. Certainly a historic moment. And to mark the occasion this morning, we're going to be doing a special edition of Coffee House Shots where we review, analyse and look back over the past 3 years. Now, to describe these past 3 years as eventful is probably something of an understatement, so you'll have to figure if we don't quite capture everything. But if you cast your mind back to June 2016, just after Britain had voted to leave the EU, David Cameron had stepped down, there was a brief, though eventful, Tory leadership contest, and then Theresa May came into Downing Street, seemingly looking invincible and ready to take on the EU in the negotiations. Now, Fraser, to start us off, do you think, casting your mind back then, do you think there was a sort of arrogance or on Theresa May's part or on the other part that we didn't understand that was going to happen in the next 3 years? Or do you think she had a very good hand and just played it very badly?
I wouldn't call it arrogance, really. I mean, I remember on Brexit night, I came into the office at sort of 2 a.m, you know, because we had completely prepared for Remain to win, as everybody had thought. And there, I think at the time, there was a 7% chance of Brexit happening. So we had to change up pretty quickly. And I remember coming in and Lara Prendergast, who was on duty, she was the only thing anybody said to me. She was saying, "Are we screwed?" Right? Because at the time, the pound was plunging and things, and everybody was complete. Even those who had wanted Brexit to happen were just amazed that it actually had. And at the time, just like after Trump's victory, the markets were plunging, and there was a feeling that we were entering this huge period of instability. And then, to my dismay, David Cameron came out at number 10 and resigned. And then the acrimony started immediately. I think I said somewhere that I thought that was a shame, he shouldn't have resigned. And all of a sudden it was, "You did this," you know. And so if I was you're immediately introduced to the kind of Brexit bitterness, which in a way came to life after the results in a way that I hadn't done during the campaign. You know, his departure, I thought, was completely unnecessary at that time. He could have gone eventually, but he ought not to have added political uncertainty to the economic uncertainty that was faced. And certainly the Brexiteers would have wanted him to stay, but he was as devastated as everybody else. Plus, he had his dirty secret that he'd banned anybody in Whitehall from doing any planning for what would happen if Britain did vote for Brexit. So he knew just how bad the situation was. And he scarpered. Had he not scarpered that day, by the way, he wouldn't have had to have gone into hiding, which effectively he's done ever since. Now, when Theresa May came back, she was, of course, a source of stability compared to the chaos. There was a horrible idea that the Tory party was going to have to go through a several weeks long leadership contest with Theresa May and Andrea Leadsom. And I think Leadsom probably would have beaten May at the end of it, because we know that Theresa May is notoriously bad election performer.
Some of her faults, if anything.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point of leadership contest. You manage to flush out the fact that your candidate is no good on the campaign trail. And the Tories found that out a little bit too. But I don't think, to answer your question, that Theresa May was arrogant. She just was trying to provide stability at a time where a lot of people thought they wanted that above anything else.
And initially it was working quite well if you look at where she was in the opinion polls, but also just, I mean, she was the surprise candidate in the sense that she even got to number 10 in the first place. Yeah. We've started this from when Theresa May took over, which is completely legitimate, given that this is supposed to be a 10-minute daily podcast. But ultimately what happened was everyone thought, were Leave to win, which seemed very unlikely, you would then have Boris Johnson as Prime Minister with Michael Gove by his side. But because Vote Leave at that point imploded, you know, you had Michael Gove turning on Boris Johnson, you had a situation where Theresa May came to number 10, but it didn't feel as though she had spent so long thinking about what her Brexit strategy would be as loads of the Vote Leave camp who had actually campaigned for it. She'd never campaigned for Brexit. She'd very quite cleverly kept her being an unenthusiastic Remainer when it came to that referendum. And that was obviously something that frustrated David Cameron a lot. He looked at what he said since then. But I think that it did mean that you got to a point where Theresa May just didn't even know what to do exactly. Mm. And we had lots of phrases which initially seemed, I don't want to say impressive, but it's easy now to
Brexit
make fun
means
of
Brexit.
Brexit means Brexit and all these things. But at the time, you know, these words things like, oh, well, this means it's a hard Brexit. People were almost trusting that there was more behind the sound bites than she was letting on. And if you think about some of the first speeches she had, you know, the Mansion House speech, everyone was really, you know, just waiting to see what these small details would be. And there was a sense that it was in her control.
I mean, Fraser, one of the, talking of sound bites of Theresa May's, I think one of the ones that came almost to define her premiership, at least in the early stages, was her Citizens of Nowhere speech. Do you think that was sort of a typical example of how maybe May didn't understand Brexit and why she got it so wrong?
Yes, well, she opposed it, of course, and then she tried to overcompensate by portraying herself as a kind of Brexit warrior princess, this kind of bizarre Boudicca figure who was desperate to get a general election to go and bash Johnny Foreigner. It wasn't Brexit, it was a Remainer's caricature of Brexit. This was the kind of cold-hearted Little Englander vibe, which the Remain camp spent a lot of time trying to depict the Brexit camp as being. And that's when I started to work out it was going to go quite badly wrong. Then there was her appalling position on EU nationals, refusing to grant them the immediate security and assurances that all of the Tory candidates had offered them. And then I began to think, well, this liberal Brexit that I thought I had reluctantly voted for isn't going to happen, and instead we're going to get this sort of Theresa May British bulldog Brexit, which I was not looking forward to at all. But then we had that wonderful general election result of 2017, one of my favourite ever general election results.
And what was it like coming into the office that time, Fraser?
Oh, well, there we go. I mean, look, of course it was a complete surprise. I remember 2015, right, I left you guys to it, and you were all celebrating and drinking champagne and stuff, and nobody expected a Tory majority. People expected Ed Miliband to win, and he didn't, and there was sort of great high spirits. In 2017, people were shell-shocked, but I thought it was just such cosmic justice on Theresa May. She did not deserve a majority. She was turning into a monster, basically, ruling with her two special advisors, Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill. And the two of those two were just bossing other cabinet members around. And if she'd won her majority, she would have been a sort of one-person cabinet. But the British public sniffed this. They didn't want it. And they deprived her of the majority, which I believe she would have used to probably inflict a lot of harm in the country. Now, put it this way, this might sound like I hate Theresa May. I think she is a noble woman who did a great public service, but she was not cut out for politics. She struggled to communicate, she struggled to lead. And so she governed in this way, not because she was mean and heartless, because it was the only real way that she knew how. She struggled to communicate so much that barking orders or doing it via her advisors was the only form of premiership that she was going to be able to do.
I mean, Fraser, you talk about the 2017 election, but I guess, Katie, one of the products of that was that we had Parliament take a much bigger role in the Brexit process, particularly with backbenchers like Dominic Grieve, Oliver Letwin, Hilary Benn, taking control of the parliamentary order paper and using it to sort of block a no-deal Brexit. Do you think, sort of looking back now, they're mainly to blame for sort of how painful this process has been for the past few years?
I think one of the truths, and perhaps not helpful for this podcast, is we will never know, had Theresa May won a large majority, what that would have meant for her Brexit strategy. I think we have signs, however, that it was different in tone than, I think, the Vote Leave strategy. And if you look at some of the comments on EU Citizens, I think it'd be much tougher on immigration than probably where we're currently heading. Mm. I don't know if she is someone who would go for a points-based system, for example, but we do know that she would be very insistent that it must go down. Now, I know people would be saying, well, Boris Johnson has said immigration must go down.
He's bullish the target.
Yeah, but exactly, other things almost undermine perhaps what Boris Johnson is saying on this topic, and his whole tone is different. Whereas I think for Theresa May, it felt like the one thing she felt Brexit was about, if perhaps sometimes the only thing, was about immigration and ending freedom of movement. And I think it would have been interesting to see how exactly that would have worked. I can't see, for example, you know, you think about the student immigration target and things around it. I think under her, it would have been almost a draconian approach to it. I think that for Theresa May's Brexit approach, the I think the ability to diverge and strike trade deals was something she was willing to go along with when she could do it with other things, but it was not something that particularly made her excited or that she felt the need to prioritise.
She really struggled to articulate the point and the advantages of Brexit, and she was, the big difference is she's far less liberal than Boris Johnson, and she was all set to basically ban foreigners from taking over British companies, and this really kind of illiberal, small-minded, protectionist mindset, and she was obsessed with this immigration target, which she knew all her cabinet members thought was insane and a disastrous idea, and she had got it into her head that she was going to prove them all right. So if she had won, she might have had a conservatism that I personally could not have supported.
Mm. I mean, one of the things you do have to praise Theresa May for, Katie, was perhaps her tenacity. I mean, I think it was, how can you imagine how long, I was looking back at previous dates and the timeline of all this, and I couldn't believe how long she managed to survive after, you know, after that general election with such a small majority. And it's almost unbelievable, isn't it?
She was very good at clinging on, I think. And also she, at one point again, Theresa May at times seemed as though she was really determined, but after a while she just seemed, came across as very stubborn. I think that if you look at what it meant for Brexit after the general election, I think at that point, regardless of what Theresa May's strategy would have been with a majority, it just became an almost impossible task. But I think that what became clear probably sooner was the fact that the Conservative Party, as it sat in that parliament, was just too divided to ever have that party agree on a single Brexit position. Mm. No matter what Theresa May picked, and she didn't have the credibility or the ability to sell, partly because she's not a particularly good salesperson, but secondly, because she wasn't a Brexiteer herself. I think in the way that Boris Johnson managed to get some of the ERG on side, even though it isn't their perfect arrangement, she couldn't do that. But I think as soon as you had a hung parliament, it just became really difficult to see how you would get anything through that, particularly because Labour weren't playing ball.
And Fraser, I think there'll be a lot of Brexiteers waking up this morning with very sore heads, but equally there'll be a lot of Remainers who will be exactly the same, especially when the People's Vote campaign. Now, it didn't seem that long ago, maybe near the end of last year, when it almost seemed like they had their second referendum in their sights and sort of the chance to completely do away with Brexit entirely. Where do you think it all went wrong for them?
Oh, they overreached right from the very start. I mean, James Kirkup wrote a very good piece for Coffee House yesterday pointing this out, saying that if they'd been more pragmatic, we would not have ended up in this situation. That they, in basically rejecting the validity of the first referendum and referring to the next one as the people's vote as opposed to the Martians' vote, that presumably the first one was, that at every single stage, they pushed it to an extreme. As a result, they couldn't carry people with them. And as a result, you ended up with a general election and Boris Johnson in number 10. So I think the Brexiteers were blessed by having a divided opposition and also a fairly intransigent opposition. I mean, if even 20 Labour MPs had voted for Theresa May's deal in the end, she'd probably still be in government now. There would not be a Tory majority of 80, and things would look very different. So there are a number of times where the Remainers could have done it better, but they didn't. So we had this cover in the magazine a few months ago, Remain's Last Stand. The point being that if Boris lost, then that's it. You might get a few rejoiners, as James says in his column this week, but other than that, the cause is lost. And to be honest, I think that there is a lot of truth in what Rod Little says in his cover piece this week, that you don't really get that much consternation now. I mean, sure, if you go on Twitter, you can find Andrew Adonis and people like that still furious, right? But that is the sort of cartoon character persona they've created for themselves. I suspect in real life, even they have come to think, okay, this has happened, it's not going to be the end of the world, and there are many, many ways that we can pursue a European future for Britain outside the strictures of the EU.
I mean, Katie, do you think there was too much of a focus in Remain circles, or people who lean towards Remain and against No Deal, on sort of parliamentary procedure and, you know, opposing Brexit through the courts and opposing prorogation, and not enough focus on sort of the bare politics of it all?
I think there have been points when it feels as though loads on the Remain side haven't been trying to win people over to the argument. But then I also think there's this sense that everyone over the past couple of years actually became more trenchant. I think people became more firm over their views. People I know who voted Leave, who were fairly probably relaxed about it, they had a preference for Leave, grew more angry over time because they felt they weren't being listened to. And I know some of my friends on the Remain side felt increasingly frustrated. They felt those on the Leave side were ignoring facts. I think that if you look at the means that Remainers eventually took to try and stop things, so the courts, clearly they're looking for direct action in that sense. However, had we got to the second referendum, I really am not sure that Remain would have had the win that lots of these campaigns seem to think they would, partly because I don't think they were laying that groundwork to change people's minds. And I think that a lot of the things that were coming out of the Remain camp, it felt as though we're just confirming their views rather than working out how you'd actually listen to people and their concerns about the European Union. So we never got to that second referendum. It's hard to see currently a route to rejoining. But I think were you to eventually get to one, if you look at younger demographics, they're still not quite clear what the argument is. And I don't think anyone's quite worked it out.
And finally, moving on to, I guess, the man of the hour, the Spectator Parliamentarian of the Year, Boris Johnson. I think now, there's possibly a temptation when looking back at past events, and then people will maybe look back on Brexit Day and see it as something of inevitability. But Fraser, it was Boris Johnson didn't exactly have an easy task when he took over as Prime Minister, do you think?
No, he had a mission impossible, really, to negotiate an EU deal, to call a general election after his party has scored 8% in the European Parliament elections, to try to win a majority. The odds against him achieving these things would be put at about 100 to 1, and actually were put far lower than that than by bookmakers. But yet, all kind of worked. And I remember that at the time when people were leaving the Conservative Party, people like Rory Stewart did so because they were just convinced that he wasn't going to get a deal and that they were protesting against this no deal scenario, which didn't turn true in the end. So I don't think anybody, probably not even Boris himself, thought that he would go into an election with a deal. And also, even when he went into the election, the idea that you would take seats in the North was seen to be fanciful by lots of people. It was only a few weeks ago that people around the sofas we're sitting in right now for this podcast were saying, oh, they're sure the Tories want to get the North, but how many of these Northerners, look at them, we're talking people that haven't voted Tory for 50, 60, 70 years. What on earth makes you think they're going to turn Tory now? And they did. And what are the odds? So, you know, there are, I think from 2014, from the Scottish independence referendum, right up until December last year, we have lived through the most extraordinary political times where the impossible seemed to be happening on a fairly regular basis. It's been an incredible time to be a political journalist, a rather disconcerting time to be a British citizen. As a citizen, I'm delighted things have calmed down, but as a journalist, I just hope they don't calm down too much.
And Katie, how would you look back on the past 3 years? With fondness?
Well, I agree with Fraser in the sense, as a journalist, you can never complain about these things. I think anyone who's listened to this podcast regularly can really attest to the fact that it has taken over everyone in the politics team's lives quite significantly.
Also, I think we've put us in touch with the podcast listeners as well.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Like,
would we be talking to people
we've
right
recorded
now?
Recorded this podcast from black cabs, toilet cubicles, probably could go on, a variety of strange places. And I think that, pardon? Brighton Beach. We don't talk about Brighton Beach, actually. I get in too much trouble about that one to this day. But the reason we got to those destinations is because politics has been so unpredictable that the idea that we'd have just said, let's record a podcast at 10 a.m. every day and we'll get everything in was just for the birds. And I still don't think we actually can do that.
Sometimes we'd record a podcast and we'd be out of date by the time that we finished talking, and things were moving that quickly. And it's funny, I remember, you know, talking to some of my colleagues at the election thinking, look, this is exhausting. You guys just want to sleep. You haven't slept for 6 months. But when we're, you know, lying in our beds, you know, 50, 60 years from now, looking back in our lives, we're going to remember having gone through this extraordinary period of politics, because we have seen nothing like it in our post-war history. And here's the thing. You don't have to be a Brexiteer to think it's had a happy ending. Because right now we are the only country in Europe with no populists in parliament or public support. We have landed in a position of political stability, which is something that hardly any other country in Europe can really lay claim to. So I'm not going to say all the drama was worth it. If Michael Gove hadn't stabbed Boris Johnson in the back back then, we probably might have got here a lot quicker. So thanks for nothing, Michael. But, you know, when it comes to political drama, it's been nothing short of extraordinary.
Well, they say the old curse is, may you live in interesting times. Those interesting times may be over. Thank you, Katie. Thank you, Fraser. And thank you for listening.